Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton and our fearless producer, Katie Galley. First episode of the week, Stone, at Atlanta Business Radio, and got a full house.
We have got a full house. We got paparazzi, we got entourage, we got videographers that aren't even here yet. We have maybe a new face on the Business Radio X team sitting in with us. This is going to be a lot of fun, but we better get started because we got a full slate here. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast VP Design and Innovation with 352 Inc., Mr. Robert Barris. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Robert, can you share a little bit about 352? What are you doing for folks?
Yeah, sure. So we are a digital product development agency and innovation strategy firm. So a lot of what we do is working with corporate enterprise level companies, trying to help them figure out how to build customer-first solutions and try to move away from just solutions thinking to more problem focus.
That sounds very consultant-y.
Yes.
Can you translate that into English?
Sure. So a lot of companies are really risk averse, right?
And, really?
Yeah,
you
I know.
Find
it's
that?
Shocking. It's shocking, right?
I bet you're not risk averse.
I'm not risk averse. I feel like there's some innuendo there. We'll get back to that in a minute. But so a lot of them are risk averse. And so what we're trying to teach people is, number one, how do you know you have a real solution that's addressing a customer problem? That's sort of our first question. And most of the time, they don't have that information.
And so how do you gather that information?
So trying to do some customer discovery or do some rapid experimentation. So anything from ethnographies to surveys with existing consumers, or even doing some rapid experiments and prototyping, putting something in the hands of a consumer in a few days, as opposed to maybe months after a solution is built.
Now, how long did it take you to land on using the word rapid?
Not very long.
So that was one of the first choices?
It was. Yeah, we think it's an important piece of the puzzle. It's still risk-averse experimentation, and I can explain risk a little bit more, but we think rapid is an important component to this.
Now, when you're working with a customer and you're telling them these things, don't they think they already know how their business operates and they don't need this kind of help?
Every time. And then my response is, when's the last time did you do a customer survey? When's the last time you did customer discovery? When's the last time you updated and used a persona? And generally, it's a blank response. Generally, it's like, yeah, we know them, but we haven't done them in a long time. Other things that we do in order to help with that is building alignment across organizations. So as you can imagine, with a large org, often sales, marketing, engineering, product, technology never sit in the same room. So we try to bring those people together to have a shared knowledge about what they don't know. Because often what they don't know is more important than what they do.
Now, what's the pain they're having where they're like, hey, we got to call the 352 folks?
Sure. Sometimes it's at the business unit level where they feel like there's some sort of inefficiency or there's some sort of restless discontent where they feel like, gosh, something could be better, but we just don't know what that is. Sometimes and more often, it's an innovation group. So a lot of times an innovation group sits within its own department, often siloed from the rest of the organization, and they're looking for ways of bringing in capability into their organization. So sometimes they bring us in to try to help build that alignment, help build some methodologies and experiments.
And can you share a story where maybe a client, you don't have to name their name, but was kind of maybe plateaued and you were able to come in and disrupt a little bit? And
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So so one client in Atlanta is a telecommunications company. I'll keep that vague, but there's a few here. Not too many guesses. But basically, one of their business divisions builds a consumer product. It happens to go into vehicles. And their innovation team asked us to come in and try to build some alignment among stakeholders because there was a little bit of a, we don't know why we build what we build, and we feel like we're a sales-driven organization. I mean, if you're sales-driven, that must not mean you're consumer-focus-driven. I think those are at odds with each other. And so we actually had that example I used before where you get, you know, the heads of all these different areas of the business together. And you look at things like, for instance, what are the features with their market research lead? What are the features that consumers use today? And when you look at a quadrant of features, everyone loves a good quadrant. When you look at a quadrant in the bottom left is 80% of the features. On the top right is about 4. It makes everyone in the room say, what the heck are we building? And why are we doing that? When you have the head of marketing say, we market to everybody.
That's a red flag?
That's a red flag. Generally, it's a red flag. So building that type of alignment is a great way to just initiate that conversation. And then within a workshop like that, we might just do a faux customer journey map. We might say, okay, let's imagine what a consumer goes through every single day. And then let's try to figure out what are the touch points where your product might intersect with their lives. And what's most shocking for that particular group is that they realize their product touches it maybe once a day.
But yet what did they think?
They were terrified. the head of strategy said something with a lot of expletives, but basically says, I don't know why we're building this stuff.
But when you found out it was once a day, and how, what did they think it was? Like, how many times a day did they think it was? Or they didn't even think about it?
They didn't think about it. So when we do a customer journey map, we try to map emotion. We try to map the device you might use, the amount of time you might spend, the number of steps it takes, who you interact with. And so they just don't think that way. They haven't built that way. And so without that type of customer journey map, all they have is a product roadmap for features that no one actually wants. So it's a rather rude awakening for these types of groups, but we were able to sort of begin to show them if you build the right persona, if you think about consumers the right way, all of a sudden you can now address a need, right? Oh, that mom of four who drives a minivan, maybe she needs a different set of features than the millennial who is, you know, 32 years old and drives a sports car. Those should not be the same product set and features. That shouldn't even be marketed the same way.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the Enterprise Innovation and the Enterprise Entrepreneurship Series?
Yeah, absolutely. So about 2 years ago, we were telling ourselves, you know, we think we have something that makes sense, like a great offering for the enterprise, but we weren't really sure who these people were, and we weren't really sure where they spent their time and how they got to where they are. Most people who work in innovation come from different areas. Sometimes it's IT, sometimes it's marketing, sometimes it's technology. But there wasn't really a career path, and there wasn't a community that helped support that. And so about 2 years ago, we said, what if we just built that community? So similar to Creative Mornings, if you guys are familiar with that series, where we Creative Mornings brings in this amazing creative talent, whether it's a producer or writer or editor, whatever it is, across all industries, and they try to bring that person to inspire other people, we want to do the same thing. So we bring in C-level executives, anybody from Equifax, pre-bad things that happened last year, to the AT&T Foundry. We bring in these guys who are heads of innovation, heads of strategy, and try to help them explain how did they get where they got, what are some methods they use to be successful, and what are some failures that they've run into? Because I think the failure and the fear of failure sometimes is too great for these people who are new to innovation to get started.
352, is there a story behind that?
So the company was founded in Gainesville, Florida. It was founded in a frat room about 20 years ago. You can tell I was in a Greek life when I call it the frat room. And basically, our founder started it then. It was a web design company. After about 10 years, it became more about software. And then more recently, of course, innovation.
And so what is your backstory? What were you doing before you landed
here?
Yeah,
sure. So I worked in advertising for about 10 years, and I got a little frustrated with sort of making disposable things, right? So every quarter there's a campaign, and you know the creative can be really interesting and cool, but it was sort of exhausting to build something that was disposable. And so I was looking to find something that was a little bit more about creating value for people and hopefully creating that at scale. So you know maybe if I can help someone save time and how they purchase a car, or save them options and when they buy flooring to make it faster and easier at scale, it could be really big. So that was kind of exciting and an interesting opportunity came about with 352.
Now, when you're doing these this entrepreneurship series and you're working with these leaders and you're you know kind of putting them on the spot, this is a regular rhythm. You said you're trying to build community. I'm just trying to understand what the experiences like. Is there an audience around there? Is it recorded and it's a video?
So once a month we get people together. So we have about 120 people come out. It's a community of about 600 business leaders. So we have them come out once a month. They hear from them in a public forum. So generally we use either Tech Square Labs or the garage over at Tech Square. And it's kind of an interview style. So think of it kind of like inside the actor studio, but for innovators. And we give people a chance to hear from them. We help curate that content with the innovator to make sure that we get out of theory and more into practice and how they actually did what they did. And then obviously we try to open it up to the audience and have a networking component for it as well.
Now let's do a mini version of that here and talk about how you leverage that to build this community within a community.
To build a community in a community.
Well, this is now a community of these hundred people. It's probably into the thousands now. Yep. And your intention, I'm sure, was to build that community to help your business. That was part of it. It wasn't
strictly altruistic.
You were just doing this for the universe. So talk about how that came into play from a strategic standpoint to help your business.
Yeah, so we started to learn more about what these people needed, right? So to take a big step back, we made a shift in our business. We said software wasn't just the solution they needed. It was something beyond that. They didn't even know where to begin. And so part of it for us was a little bit of customer discovery. We learned the things they needed. We learned that they didn't have a pipeline for ideas, a pipeline for how do you prioritize problems in the org. And then the other part of it was they also were looking for frameworks to help them essentially sell up to senior leadership. So because we got these war stories and this community of people together talking about what they knew and what they didn't know, we started to build up almost a library of stories that helped each other, both us as well as these innovators, try to find their path forward. Additionally, what was really cool is we found ourselves becoming a connector. So for instance, we're friends with a very large insurance company. We're also friends with a company that builds flooring. The insurance company says to us, hey, we have a slip and fall as one of our top 10 challenges that we pay out every year. What do we do to solve that? And my question was like, well, why don't we make an introduction to our flooring friends who might be experts in that? So being a connector was also a really important component for us. It doesn't create any business for us, but it creates a huge opportunity for disparate companies who would never talk to each other to come together to build something really neat.
And then when you're serving all of these businesses wearing kind of an innovation hat, that helps your brand, obviously, and
being
kind of the halo effect of that. Now, have you been able to translate that into business, though, in the long term? Is it because you are this community leader now and the owner of the hub, has that trickled out to getting business? Because that seems like a strategy that other firms could use in their areas that they serve.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, innovation has been the largest part of our business growth of the past 2 years. So it definitely has helped us not only meet with the right people, but also build the right types of services and team around that. So yeah, it's been a huge part of how we've been able to be successful in this space.
Now, is it helping you in terms of you're doing more design work, you're doing more consulting? Like, which has this kind of opened up new doors in different areas than you had originally anticipated?
It's opening just about the same amount of doors that I hoped for. So to break down our business, so innovation and strategy is one component of the practice. We also do software development. And then the final part is really doing go-to-market strategy and execution for a brand that's never been in market before. So many times enterprise companies don't want to put their name on a new venture, but they are willing to put something out there in the market and take a bit of a risk and see what happens. So those three services that we offer, the other two have definitely benefited from the innovation services. I mean, ultimately, if you don't know what you're going to build, if you don't know why you're building it, it was really hard to move forward. So we found that becoming more of a full service type of innovation shop, for lack of a better word, allowed us to give them confidence to say, if we actually find traction with an idea that's consumer focused, we can actually help you pilot it and then eventually maybe commercialize it and bring it to market.
Now, what is the kind of point of entry for you usually?
Like, in terms of
when you're dealing with the new customer,
like, or what does an engagement look like?
Yeah, like the first engagement, because I'm sure it's different and I'm sure it grows over time once you prove yourself.
Yep, absolutely. So a lot of times we're brought in for some hypotheses. So a business leader or someone from strategy may say, you know, I think that this is a consumer problem. I don't know if it is. I also think I have a solution for it. And so often we'll jump in immediately and say, okay, well, can we do some lean customer discovery? So maybe a matter of couple of weeks of research to double check and find out if this is really a problem. And then we can actually rapidly prototype that and put it in the front, put it into the hands of a user in just as little as 5 days. So being able to do that really quickly provides a lot of value, because generally they're waiting months before they put a solution in front of someone. And we want to do it in just a few days. And I think the reaction is generally shocked because they've never seen something move that fast. But they're also seeing real consumer behavior. So you have a little bit of quantitative research coming out of it from a UX perspective. We also have a ton of qualitative things they would just never see.
Now, when you move that quickly, though, does it just go back into the bureaucracy and all of a sudden now it's kind of a hurry up and wait? Now that you did your part fast and you proved like, hey, we're super nimble and agile and we can make things happen. And then you are like, okay, now you have it. And then you're like, where'd they go? It's been like 2 weeks and, you know, it's been longer. We did all of our work and we're still waiting for them to even just, you know, send it up one level.
It's absolutely a challenge. we try to help them in a couple of different ways. So one of the things that we offer is, you know, once we do prove something, so we prove the efficacy around some sort of solution, we then try to actually help them sell it in. So we'll help them with maybe a business model canvas, or we'll help them with a pitch deck. There's definitely going to be some slowdowns. It's definitely not an instantaneous, hey, we did an experiment and now we're moving forward. There's also clients who want to do experimentation for long periods of time. So, you know, you get them into learning quickly and then all they want to do is learn quickly before they pull the trigger. So it's really tricky. I can't say we've perfected how we do it, but I can tell you we're trying to ease their pain in sort of upselling it to their manager. But it's really tricky. We're talking about directors or VPs who are selling it up to maybe the CIO of a company.
Right. And they're risk averse.
And they're risk averse. Yeah. It's a challenge.
So before we wrap, I've got a VP question.
Yeah.
Because you're clearly right in your wheelhouse. I mean, you could talk about this all day. I could see, and I know our listeners can hear the passion through the airways, and I can just see it dripping off of you. Are you also managing results with and through other people? Do you manage other people?
Yeah. So I lead our design team across the company. So I try to mentor and teach our designers who work on product development. And then, of course, I manage our innovation team and lead the strategy for the company. So I do a couple of different things.
Well, the reason I'm asking is I can sense immediately you just have tremendous facility for everything you're describing. But on this whole issue of leading other people, do you enjoy it? Do you find it challenging? Do you have some counsel to offer other people out there that really enjoy their craft? And oh, by the way, they're trying to lead people too.
It's really tricky. I find myself a maker, right? So I like to create and build. And so it's tricky to manage at the same time and do that. So I will always have that challenge of the time piece of it. But I love trying to help build people. I'm just a people person. That's just who I am. And I'm constantly fascinated by what I can read and or see from people. So being able to help my team navigate the tricky waters of how do you make a client really happy beyond just making something is it's enjoyable. It's interesting, right? It's a big challenge. And not everyone's really good at it. So I get a lot of satisfaction out of it. And I do a lot of coaching with my clients too. So it's really interesting to kind of do it on both sides and feel like I can be a trusted advocate for both of them.
Well, it clearly starts from the way that you're approaching your work. I mean, you just bring a real energy to the conversation. This has been a lot of fun, man.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. So where can our listeners go if they'd like to have a conversation with you or someone on your team about these topics of phone, email, whatever's appropriate? LinkedIn.
Sure. So 352inc.com is our website. Feel free to LinkedIn me. It's Robert Barris, B-E-R-R-I-S, and rbarris at 352inc.com.
Fantastic. Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Hey, how about staying with us while we visit with some other guests?
Yeah, I'd love to. That'd be great.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us Executive Director with Harvard Debate Council. I can't wait for you to hear this story, Lee. I got to dive into it a little bit a week or two ago. We were going to have this gentleman in last week. It got a little chilly here in town, so we rescheduled. Please join me in welcoming to the show Mr. Brandon Fleming. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
All right. What'd you learn in that last interview?
That he's an incredible guy.
You know, we get that a lot around here, right?
He was speaking a different language, so I was just trying to follow. But
a Harvard guy like you couldn't follow that? Well. All right. Well, lean in there, Brandon. Can talk a little bit about the Harvard Debate Council and how you're serving folks.
So, well, the Harvard Debate Council Diversity Project is an Atlanta-based diversity pipeline program for African-American students in grades 8 through 11. And so what we do is we actually train African-American students here in the metro Atlanta area, and we feed them into the Harvard Debate Council's summer residential program for high school students.
And then, so your day job is kind of working with young people, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what do you do?
So I actually teach part-time at the Ron Clark Academy, and I also work full-time for the Harvard Debate Council doing this.
Okay, so are you traveling around the country doing this?
No, we're just here doing in this Atlanta. Primarily here in Atlanta, yes.
And then what is the day-to-day to serve that community to prepare them for the Harvard Debate Council?
So what we do is we actually train them on first and third Saturdays at the Art Institute of Atlanta. And during those sessions, we actually have different Harvard instructors, including myself, you know, who train these students and teach them in critical thinking, analysis, writing, public speaking, argumentation, political science, philosophy, and a whole bunch of social sciences.
Now, how important is young people, how important is it for them to learn about critical thinking? Because that seems like not all the schools cover that.
Yeah, you know, it's very important because innovative ideas are what drive our society. And so we want to cultivate and develop young people that not only come up with new ideas, but that are able to challenge the ideas that already exist.
Mm-hmm. So they have to be able to hold kind of two thoughts at the same time, at least two thoughts, right?
Absolutely. And they have to be able to look at every circumstance and every idea from both sides.
Right. And then a lot of people, especially in this political climate, it's very polarized and it's hard for each side to see how the other side empathizing Absolutely. With the other side to even see any of similarities or common ground, and that's what you need in order to move forward, right?
Absolutely.
So how do you go about teaching those skills? Like, what are some of the kind of tips and tricks to, if you were to wanted to teach somebody that?
Well, one of the ways we do that is by making students argue for the side that they actually disagree with.
Okay, so you put them, you say, like, you got to wear the other hat today, right?
Yeah, so we have this thing called the hot seat, you know, where we put a student in front of the classroom and all of the students in the class cross-examine them. Mm-hmm. And they have to defend even the positions that they do not believe. And so imagine what it does for a young person when they're able to defend the position that they don't believe. It heightens their ability to defend the positions that they do believe.
Right. So you think you can train Robert to not believe in the importance of innovation?
Are we going to do this right now? Is that what's happening?
Perhaps, maybe so.
So now, can you share some of the stories of when you start doing this and kind of the light bulb moment goes off for some of these kids? Because that must be so rewarding.
Yeah, well, we actually just started. We just had our acceptance this past, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before. So we're actually getting ready to have our very first class this coming Saturday. So I haven't gotten started with these particular students.
Okay, yet. So but something just happened this past weekend though, right?
Yes, we had our surprise acceptance.
Okay, so tell us about that.
So we selected 26 students from Metro Atlanta in our very first year of existence with very limited marketing. We had over 150 applications come in.
So people are hungry for this kind of
knowledge. Yes,
absolutely.
To the point where we're getting calls now from people in different states asking if they can move to Atlanta or if we can
wow.
bring this program to other states. And so we narrowed it down to the 26 students that we wanted. And we sent all of them an email saying that they've been selected to advance in the admissions process.
Right.
And the email specifically stated they were being invited to interview for the next phase of admission.
Right.
What they didn't know is that those were actually the students that we had already selected.
Wow.
And so those students came to the Art Institute of Atlanta for their quote unquote interview. And it began with several community leaders that they had to interact with for mix and mingle. And so after that, they transitioned into another room where they were sitting in a circle with each other and they had an audience behind them. And as a group, they were tasked to solve a group exercise where they had to explore a very controversial question. And as a unit, they had to come up with one resolution to that question. And the question was challenging. And so it was very interesting because some students stood up and some students voiced their opinion while others did not. And so the students the whole time, they were on the edge of their seats, tension was in the room. And so those kids were so nervous because they wanted it so bad, but many of them were like, man, I didn't get a chance to be evaluated. And so I said, now listen, you have one more chance. We're going to do one more exercise, and this is going to determine whether you get it or not. There are bags underneath your chairs. You need to reach under that bag and grab the shirt that's in the bag, and you need to grab the folder. Those shirts have different colors on them. You need to throw on the shirt, run to the middle, get with the people that you see with the same colored shirt, open the folder, and begin the exercise. So I say you may begin in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and frantically, each student reached under the chair, hurried up, grabbed out the shirt, and then they put it on, and then they all ran to the middle, but they were so confused because everybody had on the same color shirt. And everybody's shirt said Harvard on it. And so they opened up their folders and they saw, congratulations, you've all been accepted. And so that's when I yelled, hey, everyone, congratulations, you're all going to Harvard. And confetti fell from the ceiling and the students were jumping up and down. And it was such an emotional moment. Parents were in the back crying. Students were crying. Board members were crying. You know, I had my PR manager there covering the event. He started crying, and the videographers, you know, and the photographers. It was such an emotional experience because those kids were so happy about having an opportunity to get an exclusive educational experience.
But now the work begins. So.
Now the work begins.
Yeah, absolutely. So what can they expect at this summer program? Can you give us some insight into some of the things?
Yeah, so at the summer program, they are going to experience residential life at Harvard. So they're going to be living there on campus in the dormitories, and they're going to be attending classes throughout the day. They're going to be studying for several weeks. They're going to be trained by renowned debate professors and instructors. And at the end of that program, there's going to be a competition. So we're hoping to bring the trophy back home.
And then, so this competition, though, is for...
It's for all the students in the entire program, yes.
Right. And then how many students are in the program altogether?
About 300 students.
Wow. And so this is 25 of them?
25 of them, yes.
So now for you, what's your day-to-day? So you have this program out there in the summer. So you're working with them a couple times a month?
Absolutely, yes. So a couple times a month, I teach them. And then we're also holding... sessions for the general public. So as part of their instruction or as part of their training, they actually have to give back to the community where they're going to be teaching their peers. So we're going to open up workshops to the entire metro Atlanta area and invite middle and high school students to come and be trained in public speaking. And our students are going to be the ones who actually facilitate those workshops.
Now, how did Harvard get involved in this program, and why was it so important for them to get involved?
Sure. Okay. So that's kind of a long story. To make a very, very long story short, I'll tell you how I ended up at Harvard, and then I'll tell you how this whole movement was birthed. So I ended up at Harvard because I was coaching the middle school speech and debate team at the school where I worked. And so those students became so highly trained in debate that competing at middle schools were no longer competitive for us. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to challenge my students and say, well, you know, because they started getting real boastful and fooling themselves. I said, right. Okay, y'all think y'all good. The next tournament that we compete in is going to be a high school tournament, and we'll see how you do there. And so they're like, ooh, so scared, right? And so I just knew I was going to teach those kids a lesson. And so the next tournament comes and we go to a high school tournament.
And you're like the only middle school?
Yes, we're the only middle school in this high school tournament. And so I'm sitting in the coach's lounge and I'm doing my work because the coaches can't go into the rounds. We're just all kind of sequestered in this one room where we have to wait for the results to come. And so I'm sitting in that in the lounge.
You can't even watch them, dude.
No, we can't even watch them debate. No, we have to just sit and wait till the round ends and the students come back and tell us how they did. And so I'm sitting in this lounge. And all of a sudden, while I'm doing my work, I hear coaches talking. Y'all see those middle school kids? They're killing everybody. And I was like, wait, hold on. You talking about my kids? And so I got so excited. I was like, oh my goodness. Come to find out, we accomplished something that had never been done in the history of this organization. As a middle school debate team, we went undefeated at a high school tournament. And so there was actually a former Harvard instructor that was there.
It just happened to be there, just by chance?
Yeah, just happened to be. Well, she actually coaches at another school. And mm-hmm. so she was like, oh my goodness, I need to meet your teacher. And so my students brought her to me and we connected. And she said, there's something you would be perfect for. And I was like, what's that? She said, I think you would be a perfect instructor at Harvard. I was like, excuse me?
And so that probably happens to you a lot, right?
Yeah, so,
I've never heard. I know that.
And so she sent the recommendation up to Harvard to actually recruit me. And they did. They invited me to come up to Harvard and teach at the residential program. And so I did that. And while I was there, I was so happy to be there. But at the same time, I was heavily grieved. I was happy to be there because it's Harvard. You know, I've had such a long journey myself. I mean, my story is, I've had a long journey and I was honored to just be on that campus and to be there as an instructor, you know. And so while I was there, I noticed, however, that there was a severe lack of African-American representation. Mm-hmm. You know, there were only, I think, two Black students that were there. And I was very inspired by this young lady because at the end of the program, we have two tournaments. One is a public speaking tournament to see who's the single best orator in this entire program. And then the final one at the culmination of the program is a debate tournament to see who can take all of the skills that we've taught you and who can synthesize all of those abilities and who can bring together all of the knowledge and win and become the single best debater in the entire program. And I was inspired by this young Black girl who not only won the first tournament, but she swept both tournaments.
Wow.
And I was so inspired by her because I said, you know what? This could be more of our young Black children. This could be more. The only reason why it's not is because of access. Right. It's not because of ability. These kids aren't in these institutions and these programs because they lack the ability. They're not there because they lack the access. And so I said, you know what? I have to do something about it. I believe in the principle, lift as you climb. And so for me, having a long journey and finally making it to the campus of Harvard University, I felt compelled to do something to be able to reach back and lift up other Black people to be able to share my experience. And so I had a conversation with my superiors. And honestly, I was very hesitant because I didn't want to be the Black militant guy coming to stir up trouble. You know, I was just honored to be there. But I sat down with my superiors and I said, listen, I'll be honest with you. I'm so honored to be here, but my heart is grieved at the lack of African-American representation. And I gave this long discourse about the need for diversity. And then I just dropped that on them and stepped back and was just waiting to see how they were going to respond. And I was so nervous, but I was shocked by their response. They looked at me and they said, Brandon, we absolutely agree with you. What would you like to do? And I'll be honest with you, I had no response.
Well, now you got to step up. It's time to be the change. You got to be the change you want, right?
Absolutely no solution. Mm-hmm. I said, you know what? Let me get back to you on that. And so I went back home to Atlanta and I designed this entire program and I started reaching out to community leaders. And then I sent a proposal over to the Harvard Diversity Project, over to the Harvard Debate Council, and they approved it immediately. They said, yes, we absolutely want to do this. Here's a grant to get it started. You just let us know what you want to do and we'll make it happen.
So now you're up to 300 kids that are in the program?
Not in this one. No, in this program, we have 26.
You have 26 here in Atlanta, but in the whole entire program?
Yeah, in the entire program. So we're probably going to have about 300 next summer, this coming summer as well. And those 26 will be included in that number.
Good stuff.
And the relationship with Art Institute, obviously they embrace this idea and are collaborating with you. That's got to feel good.
Absolutely. It feels great. One of our board members, Antonio Brown, he actually does work with the Art Institute. Mm-hmm. And so he told me, he said, Brandon, I have to connect you with the president of this institution. And so he did. We sat down and we talked about what we were doing. And they were so inspired. And they said, listen, anything you need, we'll give you everything. You can use our facility. We'll give you an office. We'll give you a classroom. We'll give you everything. As a matter of fact, we believe in this so much that we want to begin your fundraising initiative by giving you $10,500 towards your goal of $88,000. And now people from all over are wanting to support and give to our program.
Well, I can tell you this. It makes me feel good as someone who writes a check to the Art Institute every quarter.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
My youngest is over there. She thinks the world of that institution.
It's an incredible institution.
A tremendous amount out of it. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So if somebody wanted to help, what's the best way to help you guys?
Well, we're still looking to raise funds. That's probably the best way to help. We're looking to raise $88,000 to pay for every student's tuition, room and board, and travel to and from Cambridge, Massachusetts. So that's our immediate need right now. We're looking for the community, individuals, corporations, and organizations to come together so we can make this dream come true for these students.
And then if they wanted to help, where can they go to learn more and get in touch?
If you want to learn more about the Harvard Debate Council Diversity Project, you can visit www.harvarddcdp.org. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Harvard, HDC Diversity. Or you can find me on all channels as well at BP Fleming.
I don't quite know the best way to plug in, and we'll certainly follow Brandon's lead, but I'd love to get some of these kids in the studio.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And ask them about the experience before, during, after. I mean, I'd love to offline get with you and see if there's not a way for us to collaborate.
These are the most brilliant kids you will ever see. I mean, their depth of thought, their passion, and their ability to articulate their convictions. It is absolutely inspiring. As the instructor, as the board members, we were inspired to just be able to sit in that room and listen to the passion of these young people.
Yeah, we'll have them debate Lee.
Yeah.
Or Katie, maybe, I guess. Probably be our best one to put forward. Well, thank you so much for coming and telling us about it. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And, all kidding aside, let's stay connected and see if there's not a way for Business Radio X to contribute to this.
Absolutely.
Effort.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Hey, stay with us. We got a couple more guests we're going to visit with.
Absolutely.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, we have life coach, entrepreneur, public speaker, and chief executive officer with Sleep is for Suckers. That seems like a kind of a thought-provoking caption there. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Mr. David Shands. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Did he have the claps? Yeah, the claps? No, don't worry about it. Fine.
Oh, you don't have the applause button ready?
Yeah. No, sorry about that.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what was your experience at Harvard like? Much like mine?
I seen it on TV. Look cool. Actually, I didn't get all the way through college. I dropped out three times, three different schools. I just couldn't get it together. I don't know what it was.
I understand. Well, I was one of the better ping pong players at Pensacola Junior College, so I can put that on my resume. But beyond that, my academic resume doesn't look too sharp either. But it seems like you're accomplishing a lot, having a lot of good fun. What are you out there doing for folks?
Well, I teach entrepreneurship. That is my passion. I used to work at the Cheesecake Factory. I was there for 6 years. And 3.5 years into it, I started this company called Sleep is for Suckers. Let me tell a story. I tell a lot of stories. So this young lady, we were at the bread station, cutting bread from my table. And she said, hey, your birthday's coming up. What are we going to do for your birthday? I said, I don't know. She said, let's go back to the same place we went last year. Everybody came out from the job. We hung out, had a good time. I said, cool, no problem. She was like, okay, cool. I'll go tell everybody. And you ever seen a TV show where like the lights get dim and it's like a spotlight on the one person and then the soft music plays? All that went down in my head. And I had this reflective moment. Because I was thinking about it. I said, wow, I'm going to celebrate my birthday at the same place I celebrated at last year with the same people I celebrated with last year. Nothing wrong with celebrating your birthday at the same place with the same people. But I was working at the same job. I remember driving home and I take my tips and I put it in the bank, in my bank account. And when I put the money in the bank, I realized I got the receipt and I realized that my bank balance was about where it was last year for the birthday. I had to buy new clothes because I had the same closet as last year. I stayed in the same place, drove the same car. So nothing's changed in 12 months. I could have literally gotten a car accident and been in a coma for 12 months and woke up and everything's exactly the same. I said, there's a problem here. There's nothing to celebrate. So I made a decision that I would not celebrate my birthday until I left my job. So 2.5 years, I worked every single day on this business. And here we are.
So that night, did you go out? Or you didn't?
Okay, I did go that night. I did go. But I was tired of it. I went reluctantly. Okay?
So you decided, I'm going to make a change. And you decided the change was going to be entrepreneurship. You weren't going to get a better job or be the manager of the Cheesecake Factory. You wanted the change to be really disruptive and then kind of shake it up a little bit.
Well, I never really wanted to be there that long, because when I first started training, I was training with a girl named Kat, and I asked her, you know, how long have you been here? And she said, 3 years. This is like training. Like, right. Training. She's like the senior person. She says she's been there 3 years, and I judged her a little bit. I'm like, you've been working at a restaurant for 3 years? A little bit judgment. And then I woke up one day, and I was there for 3.5, and then I wound up being there for 6 years. But the 3.5 years into it, I just figured I had to make some kind of change, so... I started this company and just...
So now the company is a clothing brand?
Correct. So it started with a clothing brand. And that clothing brand allowed me to go from, you know, working at my job to being full-time. I opened a kiosk in Cumberland Mall. And that went really well. And then I started teaching. People kept asking me, how'd you leave your job? How'd you leave your job? So I started teaching how to go from your job to your dream. Then I wrote a book, which I have a book for you guys. Dreams Are Built Overnight. So it talks about how to create a bridge from your day job to your daydream.
Mm-hmm. And then, so now... talk about the beginning of having a clothing line. So that's, did you know, I mean, you worked at the Cheesecake Factory. So how much knowledge did you have about creating clothing line?
Not much. Uh-huh. I used to paint t-shirts in college.
Okay. So you were kind of graphically inclined?
Not really. My art style on the t-shirts were abstract. I just throw paint everywhere and put a word on there and call it art.
All right. Like that. But if you can sell it, good for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, this is what happened. So I don't know how I came up with the name Sleep is for Suckers, but... I figured if you lose sleep doing what you love, you'll eventually live the dream that you only would have dreamt. So I started selling a brand. This is really what happened. I put Sleep is for Suckers, like small logo on the back, and I had a design on the front. The design wasn't all that cool. I thought it was cool. It's just nobody bought it. But they turned the shirt around and said, oh, Sleep is for Suckers. I like that. I don't like the shirt too much, but I like the name. So I got rid of those shirts as soon as possible. And the next run of shirts, I just put Sleep is for Suckers on it real big. And I started selling the message and not the t-shirt. And I was like, if they can buy the message, it doesn't matter what the design is.
Right.
So that's how I started selling the message. And people bought into the concept and not necessarily the creative design.
So now take us through that process to make that a business. So now you have literally, what, a 5-word business, mm-hmm. right? Or whatever, how many words? Sleep is for suckers.
Yeah.
2-4 words.
That's 4.
5 syllables.
3 words and a number.
3 words and a number. And then you're now building a business around this.
Yep.
And then, so now you're putting it on shirts. Are you doing, like, who helped you with the, I got to make shirts now, I got to pay X, I got to sell it for Y? Who's teaching that? Or you're just making this up as you go along?
Just making it up as I go along. And this is why I'm so effective with teaching entrepreneurship, because I didn't learn it in college, the technical sides of it. I
like the math side?
Yeah, I just looked at it like this. You find a design. And I don't design, so what do you do? Find somebody who can design.
So you had a buddy?
Yeah, yeah. I ran into a young lady. I said, I want to put this on a shirt. Can you make it? She said, yeah. She does graphic design. I said, cool. So I paid her like $100 for the logo. And then I said, okay, how am I going to get shirts printed? So I went on this new website. It just came out. It's called google.com.
Yes, I've heard of it.
And I typed in where to get shirts printed, like in all those words. And then these shirt printing companies came up, called them. And I said, hey, I want to make some shirts. They said, cool. Come on in with the design that I got for $100. And I gave it to them. And they said, okay, this is how much it's going to be to print it. And I printed it.
So, but you needed then a bunch of money to pay for the initial run of the shirts?
Not really. It's about $300.
So the $300 got you some money.
Yeah.
And then, so $300 there and then $100 for the design. $400 bucks.
Yep.
You now have how many shirts?
I think I got a couple dozen shirts. Like, yeah, a couple dozen shirts. But and people say they need like startup capital. I literally saved $40 out of my tips every week for 10 weeks. Like, and I think people think entrepreneurship is rocket science, and it's not.
Well, they think I got to have $1 million because they hear these stories. These people raise $10 million. So they don't understand you could do it with a few hundred dollars.
Yep. I looked at the numbers. It cost me $6 to print t-shirts, and I sell them for $25. I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. $19. Then you take some of the 19, you put it away for reinvestment in capital, and
just keep growing.
Just keep growing it.
Well, it sounds like, Robert, this is your right up your alley here.
Totally.
Right?
On a much smaller scale.
No, it's the same exact thing. It's literally, he does exactly what you do. Yeah. He does, right?
No, it really is. It's exactly what. And it's funny because a lot of people do think, yeah, it's going to be a ton of money, a ton of time. It's a ton of time. It may not be a ton of money, right? In fact, you might be best not spending any money or bootstrapping it yourself. So yeah, it's... There's a funny thing. Everyone thinks just like an overnight success. You know, people call Pinterest an overnight success. Yeah, like 7 years overnight success. It's the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, man.
I go into schools and I teach kids the same concept. So this is my experience as a kid. I used to rake leaves, and this my dad made me do it for free. It was really like slave work because he like paid me. You know what I'm saying? He paid me in food and stuff, right?
It was so indentured servitude.
Exactly. So I was raking leaves, and I looked across the street. And the lady across the street, she had leaves all over her lawn. Now, I thought the leaves were pretty. I liked the colors, right? But I was like, I wonder if she doesn't like it. So I went across the street, knocked on the door, and I asked her if I could rake her leaves. She said, yes. And she said, how much are you going to charge me? I didn't know. I was like, I don't know. I make about $10 a week over with my dad. So, $10. She said, cool. And I raked the leaves and I started a little business. But this is what I teach the kids, right? Say, for instance, you're mowing lawns. You know, I'm actually coming out with a little series where the kid, he mows the lawn, right? And he looks across the street, same story, and says, hey, Miss Johnson's lawn isn't mowed. I'm going to ask her if I can mow the lawn. So he goes across the street and says, hey, Miss Johnson, can I mow your lawn? She says, sure, $20. He says, great. He tries to start the lawnmower. He says, I don't have any gas in the lawnmower. So he asks his dad, hey, dad, can I have a couple dollars to get some gas? He says, go get a job. And he said, I don't have a job. That's why I'm asking you money, for money. And he said, if you had a job, you wouldn't have to ask me for money. I'm like, yo, this is so confusing. So I'm thinking. There's a cartoon that I'm making. So the kid has this idea. I'm going to go across the street with a contract that says all of my clients, they're required to pay a 50% deposit. So you need to give me $10 before we start. He takes the $10, he goes to get the gas, comes back, puts the gas in the lawnmower, cuts the grass, comes to get the other $10. Now he's in business. He started with no money.
Right.
Just innovation, right? But his next goal is to get more clients. But his next goal is to find another, to save his money to buy another lawnmower. And what's he going to do with the other lawnmower?
Find another buddy that can mow two lawns at the same time.
Exactly. Say, hey, you ain't doing nothing at school anyway. I give you $15 to mow this lawn. You got these contracts where you're making money. So it's just entrepreneurship.
Well, it's a mindset. Mm-hmm. And it's great that you're sharing this mindset. So now are you finding the young people are open to this? Is this kind of life-changing for them? Or is this... I mean, because it's changing the framing of how they might see a career. Because some people think it's like you thought, I have to get a job. But you can also create your own job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, kids are super receptive to it. They're starting to understand that they can have an idea and make their own money. And I love teaching kids because they got an advantage because they're young. You ever seen a kid tell you a candy bar for $5? I'm like, yo, this Snicker costs 75 cents Walmart. But you buy it. Right here, take the $5.
I don't buy it. I hate to say it. I don't buy it. No. I can't do it.
Yeah, they get me every now and again. But they're young, and I'm teaching them how to tell the story of being young and in business. That's currency.
So now, do you still have the clothing line? Is that still going in the background? You got your book line, right? You got Dreams Are Built Overnight. That's a book you got out. You're mentoring young people. So you're building a whole kind of empire here.
Yeah. And the biggest thing I have now is a small business coaching program. It's called Sleepless Nights. Night with a K, though. Like nights, like I play on words.
I'm into it.
Oh, you like that?
Okay.
So it's called Sleepless Nights. We have a huge coaching program all across the country where small businesses just have ideas and they need help. So we do like 3 calls a week. I've been coaching since this morning. Text messages, I do one-on-ones. And the testimonials, my God, from, I mean, there's so many testimonials of how people started in the program and now their business is rolling, or some people actually quit their job and replace their income just based on the principles of entrepreneurship, learning them.
Isn't there a corporate application for this as well? Surely what you're doing is very attractive, and I'm very enamored with everything you're saying about entrepreneurialism, and I'm particularly interested in young people, you know, at least exploring this mindset. But there's also this idea of, even though you may work at a really large organization, having an entrepreneurial mindset in your department or individually can be very productive for the organization. Sure. Is that something you are pursuing or plan to pursue, sharing some of those ideas with even big companies, people inside big companies?
Oh, absolutely. So that's another piece of my business that I've just kind of later last year kind of started, and companies are bringing me in to teach culture, because I built a movement and I have this way of getting people to work with me, not because of me, but because it helps them in their goals. So that's Brandon right there. He's my videographer. And when he met me, he said, "Hey, I love all your videos. I want to work with you." Right. So I'm telling him the vision. He said, "I'll just work for free." Now, I'm not sure how long that would last, but
how long did it work for your dad and you in the leaves?
Well played.
So what I did with Brandon is we had the conversation, because obviously he wanted to work with me, but it was very important that I find out what he wanted. Like, what is your goal? What is your dream? So I found out after he told me what his goal was, I figured out a way to merge his goal into mine. So now he'll come and record me for free, because he's not building my dream, he's building his. And this company that we're building together, it helps with his goals. So I teach companies how to create a culture. So a company, I actually just came back from LA. The company brought me out to talk to the owners of the company, because they were having communication issues, and we fixed it in, you know, a couple hours. And he brought me back out to talk to all of his staff. And so most companies that bring me, they bring me out a second time.
Yep. Good stuff. So if somebody wants to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Follow me on Instagram. Sleep is for suckers with the number 4. Or, hey, do me a favor. Go to sleepisforsuckers.com and buy some shirts. That's a cool way to get in touch with me. My email is info@davidneversleeps.com. info@davidneversleeps.com.
And is that the best way to get our hands on this book as well? Or
I brought one for you, babe.
All right. But how about our listeners, though? Because they're all execs and entrepreneurs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So you can go to Amazon. It's called Dreams Are Built Overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Or sleepisforsuckers.com has the book on there. Or dreamsarebuiltovernight.com has the book. So yes, Dreams Are Built Overnight. It's on Amazon.
Man, what a fun conversation.
Good stuff.
Doesn't this just beat the heck out of working? Sure. Getting to have conversations like this. Hey, stay with us. We got one more guest we're going to visit with.
Absolutely.
All right, Lee, ready for the headliner?
I am.
This gentleman has been so patient. We started him in the cheap seats. We had him play musical chairs, but I thought I saw him taking some notes. I know I saw him nodding his head a few times, so I know he's been engaged. Really looking forward to this interview. Please join me in welcoming to the show regional president with a little company some of you may have heard of, Robert Half, Mr. Andy Decker. How are you, man?
Oh, I'm doing well. I just enjoy hearing these stories and the excitement and energy that these guys brought. So I'm excited to share my story.
Well, can you talk a little bit about Robert Half? What are you guys doing for folks?
So we've been around 70 years now. We're celebrating our 70th anniversary. We're the oldest and largest specialized staffing firm. So we put somebody in a job about every 2 minutes. So the time we've spent here, you know, we found 25 jobs for people. So that's what we do.
Now, you're here to talk about kind of the market, the job market nowadays?
Absolutely. I mean, it's obviously been...
It's a little tight, right? The unemployment rate is kind of low.
So we're seeing the lowest unemployment rate since 2001. It's held very solid for a number of months now. We're seeing the highest job openings we've ever seen. You know, we've been right around 6 million open jobs at the end of every month. We're seeing about 5.5 million hires. And the economy has never seen this situation where there's as many jobs open as there are people out of jobs. So it's sort of one of those things where we have as many jobs open as we don't have people. So we're struggling to see why companies can't make matches and find the talent they need right now.
Is this where the robots are going to come in?
The robots are coming to take this job for us. It's interesting. You know, for every job that's created or outsourced to artificial intelligence, there's a higher paying job for someone who can help manage that process. So I do hear companies asking me about that a lot, and certainly we're going to continue to create better paying jobs and higher paying jobs as we bring that technology around.
So now, what does the kind of the job seeker have to do to kind of keep moving up?
You know, it's interesting right now, and certainly in Atlanta, and if you look through the years, people who change jobs tend to increase their salary every year more than people that stay. So while
is that true? Is that a real statistic?
Yeah, absolutely. Department of Labor
don't
has
don't tell the millennials.
That's
that.
Right. Well, Department of Labor has all kinds of great numbers, but oftentimes what I talk on the company side right now, it's harder to find talent, and there's not as many people out there looking as there are jobs available. So really right now, it's more the onus is on the companies. How do I attract? How do I retain, more importantly, the talent that I have in the walls already? So standing out as a job seeker, there's a lot of things you can do. First of all, you primarily find your job through your network. So let people know you're looking. Connect with great people. I mean, this room alone right now, there's a number of great people who are connected with thousands of people. So tell people that you're looking. The other thing is, I want to hire, and most companies want to hire people who want their job, not a job, right? So if I'm interviewing you, I want to know why you want to work at my company and why you want the job that I have open today. And quite honestly, that's a little bit harder to find when there's so many jobs and there's not enough people.
Now, how does Robert Half play into this equation? So like I'm a company and I have openings. Talk to me about how Robert Half is helping me, because can you really help me improve the culture of my company? Like, are we going to have conversations about that? Or am I just saying, hey, I need to find this job filled?
Well, yeah. So I'll just very briefly share. So I've been with Robert Half last week, 12 years, all here in Atlanta.
You
so
must be getting pretty good at it by now.
I mean, they have a long onboarding period. They'll figure it out eventually. But I was running a small business in the San Francisco Bay Area. We were growing and I needed to hire staff. And I was really struggling to do that. And I was trying to do jobs that really I needed someone else to do. And that's how I got introduced to Robert Half. They helped me. So we do three things I like to tell people. We find people who want new jobs. We find companies that want new people. And then we make matches. We try to help everybody we talk to. That doesn't always mean finding a job, but it might be, here's what you need to do to your resume. Here's a place to look for jobs. Here's how you go about your follow-up. So we put a lot of information out there to help people. And like I said, we find people a job every 2 minutes. So I certainly feel like we're impacting. We also do a lot of coaching with our clients saying, you know, this is what you need to be looking for right now in this market, and hopefully help them make hires more quickly.
Now, are there any tips from the company standpoint of things they can be doing? You mentioned that a lot of jobs are found by the network of the job seeker. So are there ways that they can plug into that world to serve that market so that they become kind of the top of mind choice?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that companies can do right now. And you start with one where it's, I would recommend, and I tell organizations all the time, if you're going to pay us to help you find someone, pay your internal employees as well. So have a really strong internal referral program. They're the people that know what the job's really like. They're going to tell that applicant the truth. They're going to tell them the good, the bad, the ugly. And when that person joins the company, they're likely going to come in eyes wide open. So that's something. You know, this is a time right now where, like I said, there's more jobs than there are people. So I think it's important that you do a good job. Gone are the days where someone comes into my office and I sit there and I go, okay, prove to me why you're the best hire because I know I'm the best company. Quite frankly, when there's a really good candidate, that candidate is probably 4 or 5 other companies' favorite person as well. So there's going to be a number of disappointed people. So here's what I'd say. Figure out what you really need. Figure out what you can train. I think it's important to hire for culture and then teach some of the skill set, especially right now, given sort of where we are with the candidate flow. Figure out who needs to be a part of the process. I will tell you, it's happening very quickly right now. We have companies that call us back 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later. They say, oh, I want to interview that candidate that you sent me. I'm sorry, that candidate's already on their 5th day of work at the other job.
So you got to move quick.
You know, we did a survey and nearly half the people said if the process took longer than 2 weeks, they wouldn't be interested in it. And not because they weren't necessarily interested in the company, they took something else. They were saying, you know, if it takes a company 2 weeks to decide if I'm a good applicant, oh my goodness, how long is it going to take them to make a real decision? So they're just no longer interested in that type of culture.
Now, when you're, you mentioned that some of your work has to do with kind of in niches and specialty markets. Can you talk about that? Like, what are some of the areas you serve?
So we work across all industries, but we specialize in accounting and finance. We specialize in technology, legal, creative, administrative, HR. So we're really working more in those in sort of business offices, white collar type jobs. But we're placing people, you know, customer service, just really anything that you might need to support your to grow your business.
Now, when you work in those niches, do you have people that specialize in that area, or are all your people generalists?
Yeah, absolutely. So Robert Half has always grown. Robert Half himself was an accountant working in a textile factory. And he just said, you know, there's not a good place to find qualified candidates. So he decided he found a company where that's exactly what we did. We have accountants placing accountants. We have technology people placing technology people. We have attorneys placing attorneys. So that's how our company has become the most admired in the industry for so many years. The people that are doing the interviews and placing the jobs, they know those jobs. They've done those jobs.
And that's a good lesson for businesses in general, right? To really, you know, kind of hone in on your niche, really serve the heck of it. I think, again, keeping leaning on Robert, that's what you guys are doing. You're leaning into the community that serves you by trying to be kind of the hub of that. And that seems like that served Robert Half over the years by having the people that are in the industry be the ones that are placing people in the industry because they know where all the landmines are.
Well, and they know the people. They've connected with the right people, the networks they've built. They understand the job. It's not a, here's a resume, take a look at it, see if you think this is the right person, because I don't know. Or, hey, this is a person I've interviewed and vetted, and I understand their job, and I understand the job you have open. This is why they're a good fit.
Now, do you do the activities that Robert was mentioning, like you create events for those niches? Do you do things to really immerse yourself into the niches that you serve?
We've always tried to stay very active as an organization. You know, one of the ladies that works with me, a colleague here in Atlanta, she's on the executive board of the Alliance, they've changed the name, AFWA, which is for women accountants and finance professionals. So she's on the executive board. I'm very active in Beta Alpha Psi, which is for college students in accounting and finance. We try to do a lot of events, lunch and learns. We try to do online training. We try to put a lot of information out there to really further the careers of the people that we're working with.
How's your debating? Because I know a guy.
Oh man, I don't even want to try. I don't want to argue the position I even believe in. He'll take me.
So now, what do you need more of at this point? Like you said, that it's such a tight job market. Do you need more applicants? Because it seems like there's enough jobs, but it's a double-edged sword, right?
You know, it's interesting, right? Because we do need, all companies need applicants, but what we really need, and to the companies out there trying to hire right now, we need them to understand what's really happening in the market, right? You can't hire the same way you did 5 years ago. You can't pull out a six-year-old job description and go, you know what? The last time we hired in 2010, when nobody had a job, we were able to get the sun, the moon, and the stars. We could get everything we wanted. We could take 2 months making the hire. And we could pay below market. We need companies to know that's not what's happening. That's not the reality of today. So we need them to be prepared to move and scoop up talent when it's available.
All right. To that same conversation, Lee, I think you do a fabulous job interviewing people in this setting. Hey, candidly, I don't know that you're that good at interviewing people to come to work.
I agree.
And I know I'm not good at it. So is there some counsel for someone who's working with you as a hiring manager in a company? This is not what we do. It's not our job. Is there some counsel available when you work with us when it comes our turn to talk to someone?
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, right? Because generally we make managers the people who were best at doing a task.
Not right.
Like that. I spent 10 years in San Francisco or 5 years in San Francisco and 5 years before that just training people to be managers because you take a great engineer and you make them a manager. Totally different skill set. Mm-hmm. So we do try to assist. We walk people through the process as much as we can. We give them guidelines. We give them tools. We say, you know, this is kind of how you should set it up. Follow this results. You know, look at what would happen if we do this 1 week, do this the next week. Line everybody up that's going to be part of the decision and really try to help them. You know, one of the biggest things we're counseling right now is if you're making a hire and you're sort of through your first round of interviews, generally in the past, you'd narrow it down to one, bring them back to a final, bring her back to a final. Nowadays, it's bring everybody to the finish line that can do the job. You know, because again, if you're first person, if you have somebody who you love, probably four or five other companies that love that person. But we try again, we need businesses to follow our instruction, but we try to coach as much as we can to help them make a good hire quickly.
Now, if you are a job seeker, any advice, like, should they be posting on all the online job boards? Like, what's the best way to be kind of found in the sea of candidates?
And I want to know what not to do.
Right. So, you know, best things to do right now. Certainly, when I talk about the fact that there's more open jobs than there's ever been, yet we're not making hires at a rate that we need to fill those up, clearly there's some static being run, right? So if I go online right now and I just post my job, I'm a hiring manager. I get thousands of resumes, and generally people are just using keywords. And my inbox is clogged. I might have 10 people in there that are going to be fantastic hires. I got 1,000 terrible resumes. So please, I will ask you to help people that are qualified get jobs. Figure out what you're applying for. Apply for jobs that you're qualified for. So making sure that you're not just out there, you know, if the word has cash in it because I'm a Chick-fil-A cashier, and not that that's not a bad job, or not that it's not a good job, but don't apply for a CFO because it says cash forecasting. and that does happen. And, you know, you call someone and they say, hey, you know, I didn't mean to apply for that job. No, I don't even want to live in Georgia. And that's because the technology just makes it very easy to apply for everything and splash everywhere. I think you want to do a more targeted search. Mm-hmm. I think you want to engage your network. I think you want to write, if you're going to do a cover letter, which a lot of people do like, make sure it's specific to the job that you're applying for and try to use your network. If I'm interested in a job here, I'm going to go on to LinkedIn. I'm going to see all the people that work at Business Radio X and see if I have connections with anyone. I go to a college with anybody. Maybe I can reach out to them. Hey, I'm very interested in this particular job. Can you help point me in the right direction? Reach out to former colleagues. Hey, I see you used to work at this company. I'm looking for a job right now. Who do you know? So I think being a little more targeted, again, apply to the jobs that you're qualified for. And always, you know, find a recruiter that one, you like working with, because I think that's important. But maybe somebody that can give you some advice and some counsel on your resume and certainly help you as you're looking for jobs.
Now, does it work nowadays for that kind of person that's a little bit of a renegade to kind of just target companies and go, look, I always wanted to work for Google, so I'm going to just, you know, find some people, work my network, and get in there by hook or by crook to meet some people and just kind of work my way through the back door to get the job.
Yeah, you know, to your point, the front door is so crowded right now, the line's so long. It's not a bad strategy to reach out to a network and try to engage them and find a way to get in otherwise. Now, that doesn't mean stop applying.
Right, it's an and, not an or.
Absolutely. Engage the network and see who you know and reach out to people specifically. It also depends on the job. You know, when I'm looking, if someone's sort of aggressive and follows up strongly and keeps calling me or introduces themselves, you know, and I might be hiring people who are doing business development. So that's frankly the kind of person I want to hire. Hiring for business development, the person has great manners, doesn't follow up, doesn't want to be pushy, doesn't try to find out what the next steps are. Well, then they might not be qualified for the job right. I'm hiring.
So now you're bullish in the Atlanta market?
You know, we've continued to see good trends in Atlanta. The unemployment number here in Atlanta is a little bit lower than the state. It's a little bit higher nationally. The numbers are a bit delayed, right? So the last thing we have for Atlanta is November, and that was at 4.2. We added 13,000 jobs in November. I think you'll see those trends in December and January be positive as well. And the really good thing we're seeing, which has always sort of been the leader for Atlanta, is manufacturing and construction. As long as those jobs continue to drive up and we create more opportunities there, the Atlanta economy for years has followed that.
Yeah, if you see a lot of cranes, that's usually a positive sign for the economy, right?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of websites, the crane watch. You look we go to visit a city and we look for cranes. That means that's good news.
And for you, what do you need more of right now? What could we be doing for you to help you?
As I said, just helping businesses understand what's happening in the economy, understanding how to hire, understanding that the best talent might not be the person that checks off every single box on the job description, but it might be someone who's going to fit in your culture, someone who's got the drive and desire to do well, and make hires based on a number of things, not just sort of checking the boxes.
And you're looking for firms that are in the niches you mentioned earlier, in creative, in technology, in accounting, that are looking to fill positions, it's worth having a conversation with you to kind of, even if it is to just guide them with what they're currently doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're looking for almost any company that's going to be hiring across the board, in whether it's administrative, customer service, whether it's accounting, HR, any of those areas that I mentioned before. And frankly, you know, only about 10% of people are actively looking. So you might as well talk to us just to make sure, because we give access to 80% of the economy. You know, 20% of people will say, in, you know, CareerBuilder does surveys, LinkedIn does surveys, all those people do surveys. Only about 1 in 5 people said, no, I wouldn't consider something. And that's what a company like Robert Half is doing for them. They're calling out and they're reaching out to people who frankly don't have time to look for a job because they're busy doing a job. They just know they need to change jobs this year.
So now if somebody wants to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of your website?
Yeah, absolutely. RobertHalf.com. And if you Google Robert Half Staffing Atlanta, you can go online. You can see all the jobs that we have open. If you're a company looking to hire, you can see all the different profiles of all. We put our candidate database online. We don't have their names and phone numbers, obviously. But our candidate database is out there for you to look and see what type of talent is available and jobs. And then lots of resources, resume writing, cover letters, how to get a job, how to network. We put a lot of information out there to help companies and to help people.
And you're the regional president. So are you over not just Atlanta, but in the Southeast? What's your region?
Yep. So I have offices here in Atlanta and in Savannah.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks to all of our guests today, Stone Payton and Katie Galley. This is Lee Cantor. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.